All right, we'll wait a few seconds for people to take their seats. Again, thank you for coming. Appreciate everyone coming and joining us for this our Central Valley Conference on Reformed Theology. And thank you, Dr. Godfrey, for those great stimulating lectures.
Thanks. It's always great to be here. I love Ripon. I love this church. And it's always wonderful to be back and see friends. And so I enjoyed greatly being here. Thank you all for coming.
All right, let's start with our first question. It says, you spoke in the second session about being charitable in our judgment of others, but the New Testament calls us to be on the watch for false doctrine and to openly oppose false teachers. When does charity give way to harsh criticism and even disfellowship?
That's a great question. And those borderline issues are always difficult, always problematic. I do think maybe one observation is that we need to distinguish false teachers from those who are falsely taught, which is to say there is a greater responsibility to teachers than to those who've been listening. And, you know, in the context of the New Testament, I think false teachers who are condemned in the New Testament are those who are completely abandoning the gospel. And we certainly want to make a distinction between those who have completely abandoned the gospel and those who have confused the truth to a certain extent, but in a judgment of charity might still be thought of as holding to the gospel in a fundamental way. So, you know, there's no sort of easy answer to these things. What we do need to, I think, though, keep clearly in mind is that at the same time we want to be charitable as we can to people, we want to be as clear as we can with teaching the truth. So the fact that we want to say that we think the Lord has laid his hand on someone's life and is using someone in ways that are helpful, that doesn't mean we can't rather vigorously say, nonetheless, there are aspects to their teaching or to their life that are really problematic. I mean, we've done that with Samson. I haven't hesitated for a moment to say he was sinful here. He was so selfish here. He was so wrong here. And yet we don't read him out of the kingdom. And so I think something of that balance is what we wanted to strive for.
Going back to, this is actually a question on Solomon. I originally read this quickly and was just thinking of Samson, but it says, do you believe Solomon is saved? His faith waved at the end.
Yes, I do believe that Solomon was saved. And I think we have to, although on the other hand, I don't have the Book of Life, so I can't look it up and be 100% certain. But I think we have to remember how that the history of Old Testament kings is often written. And often the way the history of Old Testament kings is written is we are first of all told how the Lord evaluated their whole life. And so often we're told at the beginning of a king's history, he did that which was good in the eyes of the Lord, or he did that which was evil in the eyes of the Lord. That is sort of the summary of his whole reign. And then we are often told the good things that he did. And even if he was a good king, then we're told the sinful things that he did. And so frequently, following that pattern, the life of a king like Solomon ends with the negative things in his life. And we may wonder, well, he went from good to bad. So did he die lost because he became bad? No, I think that's to misread how the story of these kings is told. And I think that's particularly the case with Solomon. So, yeah, we have a list of all the bad things Solomon did in his life. But that's not to say that's where he ended up. That's simply to record faithfully that he wasn't all that he should have been, even though he was a good king.
Another good reminder to always thank God for the active obedience of Christ.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah. Absolutely.
How do we reconcile the apparent incongruity with the phrase, "Then the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him," and oftentimes the resulting actions and results that are evil in nature? Hence, Samson slain the 30 men.
Well, sometimes when the Spirit of the Lord comes on Samson to strengthen him, even though he ends up doing a violent act, it's an act in the service of the Lord. So when he kills the 1,000 Philistines, he's doing that as a servant of the Lord who's being protected by the Lord and is being unjustly pursued by the Philistines to murder him, and he's defending himself to carry on his own work. I think with the case of the 30 men, that's more difficult because that does seem much more personal, much more excessively violent. Except, again, you see that Samson is reacting to Philistines who are just filled with murder in their hearts. So they were going to murder his wife had she not told him. They will eventually murder his wife because of what he does. So these Philistines are not people for whom to develop a lot of sympathy. They are murderous. And if you're ever inclined to think we need to be more sympathetic to some of these old people, to old people you should be sympathetic, but not to old peoples in the Old Testament, you need to go and read Psalm 83, which really discusses the hatred of the enemies of God's people for God and for his people and their desire to wipe them out. And Samson is really involved in protecting, delivering his people from being wiped out. So singing psalms is always a good thing.
Did you want to continue to comment on that maybe?
Next year.
Okay. So we'll have to have you back. Could you address what you think Samson meant by, "Then I will quit," Judges 15:7? I don't have a text in front of me.
Yeah. I think what he means there, Judges 15:6 or 7, is I have seen this spiral of violence that has escalated and escalated, and there's no end to it unless I quit. And so I'm going to do one more thing, and then I'm quitting. I feel like what came out of that wedding feast is over. So I don't think it's I'm going to quit serving the Lord. I don't think it's a statement made relative to his calling that I think is still to come to be a judge. I think it's relative to this cycle of violence that he's been caught up in ever since the wedding feast.
Practically speaking, why do we as the church in America struggle so much with not being the stark antithesis to the world that we should be? And then a follow-up is, how can we begin to be used of the Lord to turn this around?
Well, we were talking about that a little bit at coffee. The Lord has given American Christians so many good things. And that in itself can easily become a temptation. I remember so vividly hearing that a church and a pastor's home and family had been attacked in Nigeria by a Muslim mob. And a pastor's home was burned down. Some of his children were killed. Others just barely escaped. And we had a Nigerian student at the seminary at that time. And so I went and offered condolences when I'd heard this news. I mean, it wasn't his family, but it was, a pastor that he knew. And he smiled. And I said, why are you smiling? And he said, well, we have learned that every time they kill some of us, many more are converted. And I thought, wow, that's living in a different world with a different mindset than the one most of us live with. This fellow had been a minister to whom I had offered the condolences, had been a minister in Nigeria. He had been a minister with limited education in a very small village. He had to be a farmer a good bit of the time to support himself. And for some reason, the denomination decided he would profit from coming to Westminster in California and getting an education. And when he set out on his journey, he had never been to a Nigerian city. He had spent his whole life in a Nigerian village. And so he had to come first into a Nigerian city with all the shock of being in your own nation's city, and then fly to America to a city of an entirely different culture from anything he had known. And it was a little bit overwhelming. But in the kind providence of God, he came to our church, and because he was a farmer, he connected with the farmers in our church who really took him under their wing. And but I thought, you know, people have lived such different lives. I've heard Chinese Christians say sort of the same thing, that they live constantly in threat of persecution. And just recently we read about some of these Chinese congregations that had finally been able to build a church to worship when the government just came in and bulldozed down the churches. You know, imagine how we would react if the government came in and bulldozed down a church. Even though maybe we would have the money to rebuild it. And so the money that God has given to the American churches, it provides great opportunities, but also great temptations, that we become at ease in Zion. Well, that's an unfortunate verse to quote here, isn't it? Not in this Zion, but that we think we sort of have a right to things going well. And most Christians in most of the world know that that's not true. And so we just have to work hard. Every Christian in every circumstance has to work hard to be faithful. It doesn't come easy for anybody. But we have to face the fact that there are peculiar temptations that we face and that we have to try to become strong in the face of.
Was Samson a Christ type? Second part of that is, can you discuss Christ types? I guess maybe that could be maybe rephrased as, how would you come to that conclusion?
Well, I think I would say there are aspects of Christ's life, Samson's life, that are types of Christ, in the sense of they draw our mind to Christ and to his work. So the fact that there was an annunciation of Samson's birth before he was born certainly makes us think of the annunciation of the birth of Christ before his birth. The fact that Samson died sacrificially to save his people, in some sense, makes us think of Christ. But certainly, Samson's life as a whole is not a type of Christ. Christ is sometimes more typified in the institutions of Israel than in the individuals of Israel. So he's typified in the kingship. He's typified in the priesthood. He's typified in the sacrificial system. He's typified in the Sabbath. He's typified in the separation that Israel is called to from the world. But when it comes to individuals, it's elements of the life that seem typological rather than the whole life. The one exception may be Joseph. Joseph is really remarkable in the Old Testament in that Abraham was a great sinner, Isaac was a great sinner, Jacob was a great sinner, and Joseph almost seems without sin as he's described in the Bible. And his life is so parallel to the life of Christ. It's really striking. And yet the New Testament never takes it up explicitly. So that's sort of a mystery, too. I have a list of questions for heaven. And why the New Testament doesn't talk more about Joseph is one of my picky questions.
Would you say Samson is a type of Christ so far as he's a judge or a deliverer?
Sure.
Institution?
Yeah. And there again, just as the kings were flawed, the prophets were flawed, the priests were flawed, the judges were flawed, and only Jesus came to be the perfect king, the perfect prophet, the perfect priest, and the perfect judge. Yeah.
With the Bible as the ultimate truth, God's word, how do you discuss Genesis 1, verses 1 to 25, in light of 20th/21st century scientific discoveries taken as truth?
Well, I take the Bible as truth, and I don't take what science says as truth without any further ado. As a historian, one of the things that you learn from history is absolutely certain scientific conclusions are always changing. And I don't say that to disparage science or downplay the great value of science, or to say that Christians shouldn't be scientists, that science isn't really important and valuable. But some scientists, not all, but some scientists have made science a religion, and they act like the contemporary conclusions of science are a revelation that everybody has to accept. And so, you know, for a long time, Newtonian physics was the last word in physics from the 17th into the 20th century. And if you didn't agree with Newton on physics, you were just an ignoramus. Well, now, Newton didn't particularly challenge the Bible, so it wasn't a great conflict. But then along came Einstein, and physics was turned upside down. And now we're supposed to agree with Einstein without any doubt or any change. I think where the Bible has spoken clearly, we as Christians need to stand with the Bible and say, we love science, we love scientists, and tomorrow you'll change your mind. I mean, it's a little triumphalistic. Maybe we ought to be a little humbler. But, I think some scientists are not very humble themselves, and they need to be humbled a little bit. Because, you know, I can remember when I was in grammar school, the atom was the smallest particle of created matter, or of matter. They wouldn't have said created matter, of matter. And then you had, you know, I forget the names of all these things, but then you had things that were in the atom, and then you have things in the things. And every time we're told we found the smallest thing ever, they find another smaller thing. And I think God has deliberately set these things up this way. I don't think we can ever find a limit to history going back. I don't think we can ever find a limit to the universe going out, or at least to the created realm going out. I don't think we can find a limit to the smallest of creation. And I think God set it up that way to remind us that we're finite, and he put us in a finite world, and there's no way for us to get out of it. And that occasionally we ought to listen to the one who is outside of it and can tell us the whole truth. So,
a little bit of humble pie, right?
Right.
If good leadership is important, how do we avoid either idolizing our leaders or the abuse of power?
Oh, that's a good question. I've never found the idolization of leaders such a great problem in reform circles. That's kind of a joke. You know the old line spoken at ordination, Lord, you keep him humble and we'll keep him poor. So I do think there are people who want a leader who can just kind of follow trustingly. And the danger is it becomes follow mindlessly. I see that with some seminary students. They come to seminary and they find a professor they really like, and they want to agree with that professor on everything. And I think they lose some ability to critical thinking. My son Robert, when he was in seminary, said to me, I hope Professor Howell Jones is right about everything because I believe everything he says. Now, Howell Jones was probably worth following. But
say that.
Yeah. So, yeah, we have to We have to recognize that our leaders at their very best are flawed people. And but most congregations are usually pretty good at pointing that out. You know, it may be more of a temptation when there are people that we don't know. Like if we hear R.C. Sproul on the radio and think he's just wonderful. He is wonderful, but he's not perfect. And on the other side, I think probably the more pervasive American problem is not being willing to show to ministers the respect they're owed. God has called ministers and placed ministers, and they are not infallible. They should not be treated as infallible, but they deserve some respect for their office. And sometimes that's a problem with Americans. On the other hand, I think ministers can abuse their power, and you know, it depends what kind of power they have, and that depends somewhat on what kind of denomination they're in. In some denominations, ministers have great control over money in the church, and then sometimes abuse their power by stealing money. I've always said I think it's amazing in the Dutch Reformed Church. I've never heard of a minister get in trouble over money because he's never allowed around the money, and the deacons don't trust each other, and they certainly don't trust the minister. So it's very hard to steal money in the Dutch Reformed Church, and it's a good thing. But, you know, there are other kinds of abuse of power, dominating relationships, abusing relationships. And it just shows that sin is such a pervasive human reality. It is so difficult to guard against it at every point. We have to just be vigilant.
What do you think about churches having church service once on Sunday?
Well, it's better to have them once than not at all. I always say to people two things, both of them slightly facetious. The first thing I say is, you know, I agree with you. I think it's terrible we have two services on Sunday. Why are those ministers so lazy that we can't have three services or four services? How come we're restricted to two services on Sunday? It's outrageous that those ministers should be so cheap. That usually surprises people. That's usually not where they're coming from when they ask, why do we have to have two services on Sunday? The other thing that I have sometimes said, depending on whom I'm talking to, is to say, you know, I think you should come to church only once on Sunday if you're doing something better with your time. If you're doing something better Sunday night than going to church, you should do that. Now, the trouble is, I really can't think of anything that would be better. Now, some people say to me, well, we have a Bible study. Well, that's a very good thing. But a Bible study is not an official administration of the means of grace. And so however profitable it is, and it is very profitable to sit around and study the Bible together, it's not the same as having the minister stand up, and if he's done his work well, to say, thus saith the Lord. This is the Lord's message for you. And I was just at a worship conference, and we had a discussion of the benediction. And it was a mixed group. There were Presbyterians there. You know, you always have to be careful of Presbyterians. And one of the Presbyterians said, well, the benediction is a closing prayer. And some of us, me and to be fair, another Presbyterian said, no, that's not true. The benediction is an official pronouncement of the minister in the name of God of blessing upon his people. And you don't get that in a Bible study. And you can say, oh, well, you know, but it's true, you know, to go out with the love of Christ, the grace of Christ, the love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit pronounced on you, laid on you by the minister is a wonderful way to begin the week. And we shouldn't undervalue those things that perhaps have been so routine for us. We don't pause to think about them. But you know, you're not going out with the minister's good wishes. You're not even going out with the minister's prayer. You're going out with the word of God laid upon you, a blessing that will go with you. And then, you know, you come a second time to be able to sing psalms, to hide God's word in your heart so you won't sin against him. I mean, all of these blessings. So unless you really have something that's better, and maybe there is some moment when there's something more needful, but it's hard to think of something better to do.
This question begins with a quote. They should know we are Christians by our love, but the secular world does not see us as particularly loving, nor do various churches see each other that way. How do you account for the phenomena that every church and most every Christian person sees themselves as very caring and loving?
Well, of course, it's easy for us to deceive ourselves, so that's part of the answer, the last part of that. It's easier for us to think we're better than we are. On the other hand, I think there are so many things that churches do that are loving that the world takes for granted, or the world despises, or the world ignores, that we won't know till the last day what the tally of love is for the church. And the Lord keeps a record of these things, I think. But I think of our town of Escondido, where there's a free pregnancy services center for women who are pregnant and don't want abortion, to get all sorts of medical and other kinds of care. And the churches in town have supported that and done a huge amount of good. And you know, if it's reported at all, it's often reported as these centers that coerce young women into keeping children they don't want. There's not an appreciation of that. I think of the generations of inner city missions that have tried to rescue people who are homeless and people who are alcoholics, and have tried to help people, you know, on Skid Row. And that's usually been kind of despised as a work. You know, I think of the Salvation Army and all the work that they have tried to do to show love and provide meals. And I mean, I think there are so many of these things that are never acknowledged in the press. And, you know, I'm just amazed to see on television the people who are interviewed as celebrities who have done nothing. There was a man on CBS interviewed because he had taken art photos of naked women and how wonderful this was. And I thought, you know, A, this book is going to sell very few copies. But he gets a five-minute segment on a national morning semi-news program. And yet people are doing all kinds of good work all over the country, are never mentioned, never thought about. And the church is nowhere near perfect. We can be ingrown, we can be critical of one another, we can be mean-spirited at times, but there's an awful lot of love that goes on in the church. And most of the time when people are really in need, the church rallies around. And I just think there's going to be a great story told about that one day, but probably not on CBS News.
Our last question is, what resources would you recommend for studying regarding living separate, holy lives in a post-Christian culture? Are there resources from the late Roman Empire that you would recommend for us today?
Well, if you want something really tough to read, that's not what most people are usually after. There's this really fascinating study by Kyle Harper. He doesn't give a particular indication he's a Christian, but it's entitled From Shame to Sin, and it's about changing ethical values in the late Roman Empire from pagan to Christian. And it's fascinating. I think there have been some recent good books. Kevin DeYoung's The Hole in Our Holiness is a good book. I think we're at some danger of letting classic books be overwhelmed by recent books. And There are a lot of good recent books, but the classic books are usually better. And J.C. Ryle, a great Anglican bishop of the 19th century, wrote a wonderful book on holiness. So, you know, they're just, you know, you can go back to the Puritans. John Owen wrote a lot on holiness. Martin Lloyd-Jones wrote on holiness. So there are a lot of really classic works that we shouldn't neglect. They may require a little more careful reading because they weren't written to be quite so accessible as a lot of contemporary books are. But those would be good things.
All right. Well, that brings us to an end. Again, we thank you, Dr. Godfrey, for being here with us. We certainly appreciate you and look forward to you coming and hosting and leading our conference. And so,
well, thanks.
Thank you.
It's great to be here. This is always such a welcoming church. And thanks to all those who provided such excellent lunch and goodies in between. We could do it a few more gooey cookies. But other than that, it was...
You're not appreciating
really
the
thank you.
Almond bars, huh? No? And thank you all for joining us this day. Really appreciate it. Look forward to seeing you again next year when we do this all again. So, thanks.